Deriving Doctrine and Theology from the Bible was presented by Ron Julian on November 25, 2003, at McKinsey Study Center's Tuesday night class. This is the ninth talk in part one of a series entitled Doing Christianity. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2003. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
You're not in a position where you're able to step back and let God reveal himself in the Bible. And you can always find something to criticize. I mean, I'm going to learn a moral lesson from a book that, you know, has a psalm that talks about beating their baby's brains out on the rocks. Yeah, great. That's a great moral guide. Yeah, I'll forget it. I mean, if you want to do that, you can do that. But I would argue that if I'm willing to understand the truth of things, I would see that although there's much at first that I don't understand, that there is a heart to this thing, there is a basic backbone to this that is right. And now the question is, how does all of the flesh and bones hang on this backbone? What do I do with all the pieces? But I can see that there's something to this, and I'm going to find how does it all relate. And bit by bit, I find that those things that seem problematic, I can understand when I look at what the New Testament does with it, and the more I come to see about God, I can start to see, oh yeah, it makes sense. But there's nothing I could say to that critic to say, no, those primitive elements to what we find there are no hindrance to its being the truth of God. Because first you got to decide that there's a truth of God that's to be found there before you can figure out how it's related in that way. So, okay, so we ready to crank her up here. For the last couple of weeks, I've been giving my pieces of advice on how to be a better reader of the Bible, and my comments have focused on the issues involved with understanding what it is that the biblical author was trying to say. So how can I know what this passage is talking about? What did Paul mean when he said this? What did Jesus mean when he said this? And we've talked about things like relevant background information, the fact that it was written in a language different than the one that we speak, and most importantly that what we're looking for is the coherent argument of the passage. We're looking for the way the context all works together. Today, the issue is a little different. What I want to talk about is, on the assumption that we've come to some sort of an understanding of what it is that the passage said, then so what? What am I going to do with that? How do I move from the fact that the Bible has said X, Y, and Z to what am I going to do in my life? So we're talking about deriving doctrine, applying what it is the Bible said. For those of you who were here last week, you may recall I told a story about my first sort of independent interpretive judgment, that I was involved in a church group that understood Paul to be saying in 2 Corinthians 3 that when Paul says our adequacy is from God, that this was a promise that all Christians, if they would trust in the power of God and rely on it in a certain way, would find a supernatural adequacy for whatever they were taking on, especially supernatural adequacy in ministry. And I said that I was sitting in a Bible study and looking at the passage, and that it occurred to me while I was looking at it that in the context Paul was saying something else, and that when he was talking about our adequacy is from God, that I thought, looking at the context there, and I have only become more convinced since that time, that Paul was saying that his adequacy as an apostle, as a minister of the gospel, was from God, and that that's what it was that he was talking about. I told you I'd finish that story because it's relevant, very relevant to what we're talking about today. I was quite pleased with myself for having sat and read the text and gotten what I thought was a better understanding of what it is that Paul was getting at. And I excitedly communicated to everyone in the group that, you know, I explained, look, see how the context goes here and everything. And I did not receive the acclaim that I was expecting to receive for having figured this out in this passage. Instead, everybody pretty much hated it, including the adult leadership of this Bible study. And one of those leaders said to me, in explaining why it was that this was a bad idea, what I had said, this couldn't possibly be true. The Bible is God's love letter to me. And if that passage is talking about Paul instead of me, then it is not relevant to my life. Well, that statement struck me in a powerful way, because I had seen what I thought was a better way of understanding what the text was saying, and this person was rejecting that way of understanding it because the text had to be, since it was God's love letter, had to be directed specifically to me. I have to be able to pick it up and say, yeah, that's talking about me, or else it isn't relevant to me. So the question arises, how is the Bible relevant to me? I mean, in what way does it tell me something that gives me something to act on, something to decide, something to do? I'd like to propose that the model, the Bible is God's love letter to me, is not an adequate model, because it misleads me into thinking that all I have to do is just pull the verses out and directly apply them to my situation, and that that's how I derive doctrine, that's how I apply what the Bible is saying, the way I would if someone had written a letter personally to me, and I just took it and immediately said, yep, that's for me. There are other models, I think, that we want to reject. The model that says the Bible is an instruction book for how to live life. The problem is not that the Bible doesn't tell me things that are relevant to the question, how should I live my life? It does, absolutely. But the instruction book model, again, sort of suggests that it's like when you get something you're trying to put together, you take it out and you follow the instructions. You say, okay, I'll do this, I'll do this, I'll do this, just like it says, and then everything will go okay. I would argue that's not the way that we end up deriving doctrine from the Bible. That's not how we understand what to do from what the Bible says. So I want to talk tonight about how I think it is that we decide, what am I going to do given what it is the Bible has to say about things. I would argue that the Bible is a book in which God has told the story of his stepping into history and revealing things about himself. He has told us true things about who he is, what his purposes are in creation, what he values, what he is like. Like anything in life, when I know the way things are, when I understand what is true, then I have a better idea of what it is I ought to do. If I think I'm in a situation where the people I'm working with are on my side, I'm going to conduct myself one way. If I find a new piece of information that tells me no, as it turns out these people are working against me, now I'm going to change the decisions I make and the way I do things, because I've gotten a different picture of the way things are. I may not have specific instructions, do A, B, C, and D, but I have a picture of how things are that is going to set for me the parameters in which I'm going to operate and how I'm going to decide about things. So I would argue that what we do when we come to the Bible is, having tried to find out what it is that the biblical author was saying, I have to ask the question. I have to ask the question. Why was it said? What was the author's purpose in saying this thing? In asking that question, I'm going to ask a related question. What are the truths and the unchanging principles that the author was drawing on, was communicating in what he said? When I think I see the truths that the author is acting upon, is drawing upon in what it is he said, then I'm going to take those truths and I'm going to make them a part of my picture of the world. I'm going to change the way I look at the world because now I have new information about what is true. And then finally, as I live my life, I'm going to make the decisions in my life out of that new picture of reality. So I want to flesh this out with some examples tonight. But basically, the model that I have is, in the biblical text, the author has said something that is based on his understanding of timeless, unchanging truths about God, about human beings, and so on. I want to find what those timeless, unchanging things are. I want to build them into the way I look at the world, and then I want to act out of that new picture of the world. That's how I derive doctrine from the Bible. I have found very helpful David Crabtree's comments on this topic. He's thought a lot about this, and I think very wisely. One of the things that's been very helpful to me is his analogy from being a parent. He talks about how we as parents will give specific instructions to our children. Do this. Don't touch that. Don't go over there. Don't get on top of that thing. But in the process, it is not that our children just take in a set of rules that they apply. Okay, I know I'm not supposed to touch the television. Because the problem is that in their interaction with their parents, they discover that sometimes they're told not to touch the television, and in other times they're told, would you go turn the television on? So it's not that there's this one rule that's involved with the television. There seems to be something else involved. And so you start to figure out, what is it that my parents have on their mind? Maybe it's my safety. Maybe they're really fussy about whether things get dirty or not. Maybe they don't want to pay to repair broken equipment or whatever it might be. But I start to gain a picture of the values that inform my parents' choices based on the specific instructions they give me as I'm going along. But in the end, I don't have this list of instructions that I operate out of when I try to keep my parents happy. I have a picture of what they are about. What are their values? What do they want? And that's the same model, I think, that we have when we come to the Bible. I'm trying to get a picture of what God is about. What are His values? What does He think is good? What does He think is bad? Has He said He is doing in the world? What is the purpose of the things that I find in my life, and so on. So, when we come to a passage like the 2 Corinthians passage that I was talking about, I couldn't have said it then, but I would say now that, just suppose for the sake of argument that I'm right and that Paul is saying in that 2 Corinthians passage, God has made me adequate as an apostle of the gospel. I have been empowered by God to do what I could not have done myself, which is to be a minister of the gospel in the way that I am. I wouldn't have understood it. I couldn't have come up with it. This is all God's doing. Nonetheless, I am a minister of that gospel. Let's suppose that that's what Paul's saying in that passage. Well, it's true. It's not as jazzy as what my friends back then thought it was saying. It sounds pretty cool to think, if I do a certain thing, I can get God to supernaturally empower me to always be adequate. That sounds pretty intriguing. And in comparison, to have Paul saying, I am competent to be an apostle by the power of God, doesn't seem nearly as exciting. But I would argue that if in fact that's what Paul is saying, what he's saying there is incredibly relevant to me, because it is a part of my picture of reality. I'm going to put together a picture of how are things, what is true, what am I going to believe, what am I not going to believe. And part of what Paul has communicated to me there, if that's indeed what he is saying, is, look, you Corinthians, as he was talking to them, here's how you ought to think about me. At this point, your suspicion of me is misplaced. You have more than enough evidence to know who I am and what I'm about. I'm your apostle. I have been empowered by God to proclaim the gospel among you. You need to listen to that gospel. I know that I'm no big deal, but this is the truth that I'm teaching to you. And I know it is because God has empowered me to be a minister of this gospel. I am fulfilling His purposes in doing this. Well, that message to the Corinthians is relevant to me, because part of the issue I face as a human being is, who am I going to listen to? What weight am I going to give the various voices around me? And Paul's saying, well, I'll tell you the sort of weight you ought to give to what I'm telling you here. You ought to give it the sort of weight that you would give to someone who has been empowered by the Spirit of God to speak the truth about the fundamental issues of life. That's the sort of weight you ought to give it. Now, that's a big deal. It may seem like a sort of an abstract question at times in my life, but there's going to come that spot where I hit the wall and I face the question of whether I really believe this stuff or not. And one of the things I'm going to have to chew on at that spot is, this is who Paul claimed to be. This is what he thought of the ministry that he had. And that's very relevant in the bigger picture. It may not tell me anything that is going to change my specific behavior right this minute, but it gives me a picture of the way things are that can affect many decisions that I'm going to make over the course of my life. Okay, so let's talk about some other examples here. Let's think about the Old Testament here for a minute. That's always an interesting place to go. You'll remember in 1 Corinthians, Paul is in the process of defending the idea at a certain point in 1 Corinthians. We're in chapter 9, I believe, where he's defending the idea that it is appropriate for him as an apostle to receive payment, that God intended that those who minister the gospel would make their living from doing that. And there's nothing wrong with him being paid. He's saying all this only so he can turn around and say, but in fact, I didn't take any payment from you Corinthians. I had the right to do it, but I didn't. But in order for him to make his point about having rights and not using them, he first has to demonstrate that he has the right. And so he argues, I have the right to be paid by you. And one of the things he does is he quotes from the Old Testament. And I might as well read it out instead of doing it from memory here. He says, for it is written in the law of Moses, you shall not muzzle the ox while he is threshing. God is not concerned about oxen, is he? Or is he speaking altogether for our sake? Yes, for our sake it was written, because the plowman ought to plow in hope and the thresher to thresh in hope of sharing the crops. Okay. Here's what I see Paul doing here. There is an instruction in the Mosaic law, the law that Moses gave to Israel. There are many specific instructions in the law that Moses gave to Israel. Paul has already taught his Gentile readers that they are not under the covenant of the law. They are not under obligation to meet the requirements that were put on Israel in terms of what they eat and all these various regulations that you find in that law. So why is Paul quoting this specific command not to muzzle the ox? What does it have to do with the Christians that he's writing to, who supposedly are not even under the Mosaic law anyway? Well, Paul has this understanding that the requirements that are given in the law are given for various reasons. That the commandments that you find in the law represent in one way or another some sort of revelation of God's values and purposes. Now, there are a variety of ways that that can be true. But in this case, he's saying, think about this commandment. Don't muzzle the ox. Is it the case that the reason God gave this commandment was his priority was how Israel treated animals? He's saying no. Now, it's not that he was unconcerned. When he says he wasn't concerned about oxen, I don't think he's saying he doesn't care about how you treat animals. But what he's saying is this commandment was not fundamentally about animals. It was a picture of something bigger. And the picture is, if you've ever thought about this picture, the ox is hooked to this wheel. And the ox is sitting there and he's walking around in a circle all day and he's turning the wheel. And the wheel is breaking up the grain. This is, instead of a water wheel sort of mill, this is an ox-powered mill. Well, so naturally the grain is kind of spilling out all over the place as it's being ground up. And so in order to make sure that they didn't lose any grain in the process, they would muzzle the ox so that the ox couldn't eat any of the grain that it was breaking up while it was doing it. Well, the command is, no, don't muzzle the ox while it's breaking up the grain. You can see the kind of principle that would be involved there. What kind of a cheapskate are you that here is a creature who is working on your behalf? It's not the ox's grain that's being ground up here. It's your grain that's being ground up. And yet, you're too cheap to let it eat some of it while he's grinding it up on your behalf. There's something mean-spirited and petty about having the ox work for you and you not willing to do anything for it while it was doing it. But what Paul is saying is, when we understand that that's the idea behind it, we see that it actually extends a lot farther. It's not just about an ox. It is about anyone who is working for someone else. And so he is saying, yes, for our sake it was written, because the plowman ought to plow in hope and the thresher to thresh in hope of sharing the crops. It's a general principle that is being illustrated there, that there is something wrong and inappropriate about having someone doing work on my behalf and not letting them be paid, be compensated for the fact that they're expending their effort to do something for me. And so Paul applies that then to his situation as an apostle and says, in essence, there would be something cheap and petty about me exerting myself to proclaim the gospel to you and you being unwilling to take care of my needs for food and shelter and that sort of thing. And then he turns around and says, but my choice has been not to take money. So he's not trying to convince them to pay him. He's trying to convince them that there would be something wrong to be unwilling to pay him and that there's nothing wrong with accepting payment in principle. By rights, he could have accepted payment and it would have been all right. Okay, well, you see what's happening here. This is, I think, a model for a lot of things that we see in the Bible, and in the Old Testament especially. Paul applied that particular commandment in the Old Testament by arguing, this is what God is concerned with here. This is what it's about. This is why he did it. And when we see why he said this specific thing, I can extend the principle then into areas that are far beyond how you treat an ox. These are people who may not have any oxen, and yet he's saying this command tells you something that you need to know. So what we have here is an example of Paul deriving doctrine from a passage in the Old Testament. We have to ask that question, why was this given? What is it behind this statement in order to understand how to take the principles that are involved there, build them into my view of life, and act on them? Think about the controversy that has been raging in the church over the issue of homosexuality. One of the arguments that you will find made is you will find those who argue that homosexuality is an immoral practice arguing from restrictions in the Old Testament. There are prohibitions against homosexuality in the Old Testament. Those who don't believe that there's anything wrong from a biblical perspective with homosexuality argue back and say, well, the Old Testament is filled with all kinds of commands that we don't obey anymore. What does it matter whether the Old Testament has a prohibition against homosexuality or not? On the one hand, that's not a bad point to make. I mean, that argument in and of itself needs to be addressed, because it is true. There are many passages in the Old Testament that say, do this, and we would say now, I don't have to do that. And there are passages that say, don't do that, and we would say now, it's okay to do that. So, who am I to come along and say, the Old Testament said not to do this, so you shouldn't? Because there's lots of passages like that that I would, at this point, ignore, in the sense that I am doing things that it said not to do, and not doing things that it said to do. So what sort of an answer do we give to that? Well, I would say that it comes back again to that question. I have to understand why a particular statement is made in the Bible in order to know how to apply it to the situation that I'm in. The example that always struck me forcefully, many of you have probably heard me talk about this before, but in Leviticus 19, we find the very famous statement that you shall love your neighbor as yourself. And immediately after it, we find a prohibition against wearing clothing that mixes two kinds of fabrics together. Within just one or two verses of each other, we have these two statements. Clearly, the Jews at the time of Jesus and Jesus himself believed that there was a way that you evaluated the question of how important, how demanding, how applicable a particular statement is, because you'll remember that Jesus and many of those that he talked to agreed that the commandment to love your neighbor as yourself was one of the great commandments. In essence, that's a summary sort of statement that captures the will and purpose of God in a pretty straightforward and profound way. Another of those statements being, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul and strength. So loving God and loving your neighbor as yourself are two fundamental commandments in the Old Testament. And yet, nobody was saying that the third great commandment is make sure that you don't mix two kinds of fabrics together when you get dressed. Everyone understood that there's a difference between those. Well, I shouldn't say everyone understood, but thoughtful people, Jesus understood this, and many of the people he talked to understood that there was a difference between those kind of commandments. Well, what is the nature of that difference? I think we recognize that love your neighbor as yourself is itself a statement of a general principle that is just true. That there is a truth about the fact that I am created in the image of God and you are created in the image of God, and thus it is appropriate that I be as concerned about your welfare as I am about my own. There's something just and right about that, and it's applicable across the board. When it comes to a commandment about mixing two fabrics together, why did God even say such a thing to Israel? Why did he ever say that? Is it because there is something intrinsically immoral about mixing two fabrics together? I doubt that that's the case. I think most people would doubt that that's the case. And yet he did give the commandment. We know that God gave some commandments to Israel because he wanted them to be distinctive in the way they did things, and also because there was something symbolic in the command that was given them, something that was exemplified in the command. And I would argue that the commandment not to mix two fabrics together is based in the idea of holiness, that there are certain things that do not go together. The idea is you don't want to have a little of this and a little of that. You want to go for the whole thing. You want to pursue the things of God and only the things of God, and not mix it with and dilute it with other things, or you know, something along those lines. The idea of not mixing things but keeping things pure is a theme that shows up a lot. So, I mean, we could argue over the specific intent of each of those commands, but what I'm saying is, in order for me to know what to do with them, I have to have some idea of what are they about. Why were they given? The command, love your neighbor as yourself, was given because it states a fundamental reality about the moral structure of the universe, the way I have been created and reflecting the character of God. The commandment about fabrics is rooted in a fundamental truth about ultimately there being no mixing of light and dark, good and evil, and that sort of thing. But in and of itself, the practice is neither wrong nor right. It only was intended to be a religious practice that gave a picture of a certain thing. So, when I look at the Old Testament, is the Old Testament relevant to me? Can I apply it to my life? Absolutely. But each part of it I have to apply in the appropriate way. The commandment, love your neighbor as yourself, I apply sort of directly and immediately because it is such a strong statement of a general principle. The commandment to mix two fabrics together, I apply by understanding that I am called to holiness and I should not compromise in my pursuit of holiness or something like that. Okay. I recognize that what I'm saying, I have to understand why it was said in order to ultimately know how to apply it to my life, is going to be controversial for some people. Because many people have argued and will continue to argue that if the Bible says to do something, you don't stop and ask why, you just do it. And if the Bible says not to do something, you don't stop and ask why, you just don't do it. So, this idea that somehow I have to understand the purpose of what was being said in order to actually obey the intent of what the Bible is saying and apply it to my life in a relevant way might sound like a way of evading the force of what the Bible's saying. But I would argue that this is what you have to do. that there's actually no virtue in just doing the statements in the Bible, reading something in the Bible and saying, it says this, so I'll do it, without understanding what it is that the statement was talking about, why it was said, and what it was actually getting at. We can see this very clearly, I think, in the interaction between Jesus and the Pharisees. And some of you have probably heard me talk about this before as well, because I think it's a great model. Take the issue of marriage. The Pharisees looked back into Deuteronomy and they said, right here, we have a command that talks about how if a man gives his wife a certificate of divorce, and she goes away and marries someone else, and then she gets divorced from that guy, she can't come back and marry him again. This is a command that Moses gives. And so they look at that and they say, well, look, Moses talks about giving the wife a certificate of divorce. This is in the law. This is the Mosaic law. And it talks about giving a certificate of divorce. That must mean that it is a righteous thing to do, to give a certificate of divorce to your wife, because Moses in the law says you can give a certificate of divorce to your wife. So they would look at that and argue, some of them, there was a debate amongst the Pharisees, but some of them argued, see, the law sanctions divorce. If a righteous man is going along and asking, what is the will of God as it is revealed in the Bible, he can say to himself, the will of God as it is revealed in the Bible is that if I want to, I can give my wife a certificate of divorce and send her away, and I'm still keeping the law. I'm still within the bounds of what it is I'm supposed to do. So Jesus' response to the Pharisees is, haven't you read where it says that for this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife and the two shall become one flesh? Therefore, what God has joined together, let no one separate, he says. Well, the striking thing about his response to them is they're looking at a passage that talks specifically about divorce and says, when you give your wife a certificate of divorce, and they're saying, look, we've got it. It's in black and white. You can do it. What Jesus is saying is, yeah, but you can't understand what God had in mind in what Moses said over here until you understand what sort of a thing marriage is supposed to be. In other words, you can't take that verse by itself, even though it says you can have a certificate of divorce, you can't take that as the statement about divorce, because apart from understanding what God thinks about marriage, it's incomplete. You don't see the picture. When you see what God has said about marriage, you see that God's intention is to take two people and bring them together and make one flesh of them, make one life of them, and he has joined them and let no one set them apart. But then Jesus says, Moses gave this commandment because of the hardness of your hearts. So when I look at what God says about marriage, I understand that divorce is not this equally righteous option to staying married, because Moses said you could do it, but rather it is an allowance that was made for the inevitable fact that sometimes marriages come to the place where the people do not want to be married anymore, and they will not be married anymore, and how are we going to handle it? It was because of the hardness of your hearts, that because it's a reality that the evil of the human heart is going to create, that situation came about. But it by no means does it indicate that God is indifferent. You know, divorce is just as good as marriage because Moses said so. Here we see Jesus modeling for us that picture that I can't really understand a specific instruction in the Bible without relating it to that overall picture of who God is, why was this given? And I can't answer that if I don't know the God who is giving it. The same thing is true on the subject of the Sabbath. The Pharisees got on the case of the disciples of Jesus because on the Sabbath they were going through the wheat fields and picking the grain and eating it as they were going along. And according to the Pharisees, this was working on the Sabbath. And Jesus, in response to them, very interestingly, he says things like, well, haven't you read about the time when David went and ate the showbread? That's not about the Sabbath. It doesn't have anything to do with the Sabbath. Haven't you ever read where it says, I desire mercy and not sacrifice? The only passage that sort of indirectly deals with the Sabbath is he says, haven't you read that the priests work on the Sabbath? So what Jesus is saying again is, yes, okay, we have commandments in the Old Testament that say something about a Sabbath. We Jews have these instructions given through Moses that say there is a Sabbath and you're supposed to keep it. But you can't understand the purpose of those commandments. You can't understand God's values and how it is that I can be obedient to that and what I'm actually trying to accomplish in my life in keeping the Sabbath if I don't understand the rest of God's character. When I see that God desires mercy and not sacrifice, it tells me that there's something more important to Him than religious ritual and so on. So again, in order to apply the passage as a Jew back then, how did I decide what does it mean? What does God want from me when He commands me to keep the Sabbath? I can't really understand that unless I understand why He gave it. And I can't understand why He gave it unless I've gotten the full picture of who this God is. It's always potentially misleading to just grab a verse and say, ah, this is the instruction that I've been given. Okay, so I hope I'm being successful in communicating the picture that I'm trying to get across here tonight. I want to, in the passages that I find in the Bible, derive from them a picture of what God wants, what He has promised, what is true, that I can use then to make decisions about how I'm going to do things. For example, we can see an example of the sort of thing I'm talking about. I think I talked a little bit about this in the answer to a question before. In the book of James, James talks to, he's speaking into a situation where the poorer Christians are being misused, abused by the wealthy landowners, and the response that some of those Christians have had is they're basically trying to curry favor with the rich, and they're ignoring those who are even poorer than themselves. And he tells this story about when a rich man and a poor man comes into their assembly, and they basically say to the rich man, hey, sit over here in this nice seat. And they say to the poor guy, well, you go and sit back there in the corner, or, you know, get out of the way here. I got this rich guy to talk to. Don't bother me. Well, how is it that the Christians in that situation ought to have decided how to act? What is it that would tell them, how should I treat this poor person and this rich person as they come into the congregation here? Well, what James does is he reminds them of the truth of the gospel. In particular, what he reminds them is, look, the riches that this rich man has that you think are so valuable and that you would like to get your hands on some yourself, he's going to lose it. It's going to go away. It's going to be gone. He's high and raised up now, but he is going to be humiliated and brought low. The person of faith No matter how little they may have in this life, they stand to inherit the promises of the kingdom of God. And thus, in the end, they will be raised high. So, if you had a clear picture in your mind of reality, of the way things really are, you would look at the rich man, and in this situation, the rich man is described as blaspheming the name of Christ and dragging the Christians into the courts and this sort of thing. So we're talking about fundamentally a rich unbeliever here. You look at that rich unbeliever, and he is on a path that is leading him to nothing. And you look at the poor believer, and he, James says, is rich in faith. He is on a path that is leading him to everything. That's the truth. If you could, you know, run the film forward and see how this plays itself out, this guy that you're so worried about keeping happy is going off the cliff. And this guy that you're ignoring, in the end, is going to end up richer than that rich man now could ever imagine. Rich in everything, in life, in holiness, in fulfillment. Anything that wealth could give you a little taste of in this life, he's going to have many times over. If you could run the film forward, that's what you would see. That's reality. That's the truth. That's the way things are. So, explain to me again then why it is that you're sucking up to this guy who's headed off a cliff and you're treating this guy like dirt who in the end is going to be richer than you can possibly imagine. Explain to me how did you come to decide that that was a good way to conduct yourself? It's because you have a different picture. You don't have the same picture in your head of the way things are that I do, James is saying. You should have that picture because you say you believe the story about the gospel. But the gospel has told you that when you run the film forward, this guy comes up and this guy goes down. So the question you have to face is, do you believe that or not? Well, I give that as a picture of how a change in my worldview can determine for me the way I am going to live my life, the choices I am going to make. The story of the gospel, that those who believe in the salvation that Christ offers will find in the end life and fulfillment, and those who have nothing but the riches of this world now are going to lose it in the end, that story is not a command specifically. It doesn't say do X, Y, and Z. It's a picture of the way things are. But that picture of the way things are has profound implications for how I'm going to live, what I'm going to choose to do. And so again, the model fundamentally of how I apply what I find in the Bible is, in the Bible I find a story about what is true, about what reality is like, what God is like, what I am like, what is valuable and worthwhile, what is lasting and what is not lasting. And I'm reforming my picture of the way things are so that I will better understand how to live, what to do, what to choose to believe, what to choose to pursue in my life, what to choose to avoid. Okay, now I have one more point I want to make, and then I will open it up for some questions. I think some of us have inherited a picture of the way the Bible shows me how to live as being, in essence, a series of rules that are applicable in various situations. You tell me what's going on, and I'll tell you the rule that tells you what it is you're supposed to do. So it's one level. I mean, we have 13,000 different situations we might face and 13,000 different rules that apply to them. And let's just go along and say, okay, this is situation 275 and rule 275 says you're supposed to do it like this. I would argue instead that what the Bible presents us in the truths that it tells us, the values that it tells us that God has, is that it gives us a hierarchy of values. That it tells me that some things are most important, other things are valuable but not as important, and the way I make decisions about what I'm going to do is not so much applying rule 275, but it is wisely bringing together the values that I know are godly and right, and seeing in this situation what that hierarchy of values tells me would be appropriate. Let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. Many people get confused by the fact that Paul is very insistent that Titus, the Gentile, did not need to be circumcised. The Jewish Judaizing party tried to put pressure on Paul to have Titus circumcised. And he says, no way. No, it's not going to happen. We did not give in to that for a minute. There's no way that we are going to give in to any of that kind of stuff. And then we read at another place that Timothy, Paul, has him circumcised. He may have done it himself. He's an adult. He had him circumcised. So, what's the deal, Paul? Over here you're saying no way, and then over here he goes ahead and says, yeah, let's do that. What? Why? What's the inconsistency there? I mean, what can you be thinking? Well, the thing about it is, it's not that there's a rule that says yes you do or no you don't. It's rather there are a set of truths, of principles that have a certain hierarchy of value to them out of which Paul is operating. High on Paul's list of values is clearly communicating the gospel. Not letting the gospel be perverted. The gospel is a message that is true and is so important in its truth that it is a top priority that we communicate it clearly. So in the situation in Galatians, where Paul is addressing that issue, the Judaizers are saying circumcision is necessary to be saved. You have to keep the Mosaic law in order to find salvation. God will not accept you if you are not Jewish, basically, if you have not converted to Judaism in your practices. Paul's saying that is a profound corruption of the gospel. We cannot stand for that for a minute. And if someone puts pressure on Titus to give in to that, we're going to stand firm and say, no, it will not happen. Because there's no way that I want to give anyone the impression that, yes, it is necessary to keep the Mosaic law in order to be saved. With Timothy, I would argue that a different set of issues comes into play. The truth of the gospel is not at stake. Nobody's suggesting that Timothy has to be circumcised in order to be saved. Paul is going to go out on a missionary journey, and he wants to bring Timothy with him. And Timothy is already racially half Jewish. He is half Gentile, half Jewish. Paul wants to be able to take Timothy into the same situations that Paul can go into as a Jew, going into Jewish synagogues and proclaiming the gospel. Timothy is a Jew. He can take advantage of the fact that he's a Jew if he conforms himself to Jewish practice enough that he can get entry into the group and have a chance to talk to them. Now, sooner or later, the question is going to come up, what is this gospel that you and Timothy are preaching here, Paul? And are you saying that a person doesn't have to be Jewish in order to be saved? And at that point, Paul and Timothy are going to say, yes, that's right. That's exactly what we're saying. But at least they had the opportunity to make that statement because they, for the sake of love, for the sake of getting a hearing with the other person, they adapted themselves to and made, they, in other words, Timothy had a freedom not to follow the Jewish law. He himself had the personal right to not do it. He was under no obligation to do it, but out of love for the other person, out of a desire that they have a chance to hear the gospel, the priority of giving them a chance to hear the gospel was a higher priority than exercising my freedom not to follow Jewish practices. He decided to follow some Jewish practices so that they would have a chance to hear the gospel. So there's no inconsistency, because it's not that there was a rule that said either you can't get circumcised or you must get circumcised. Instead, there are a set of principles out of which Paul is operating, and he very consistently applies those principles. What changes is the situation. What is it that's at stake in each situation? And so my last comment that I want to leave you with here, then I'll open it up for questions, is the sort of thing that I'm talking about here tonight, especially that last point that I just made, you will find people who will describe what I just talked about in a negative way as situation ethics. And I say, well, see, that's the problem with what Ron's saying there. That's situation ethics, and everyone knows that that's wrong. I just want to clarify, to make sure that I'm communicating right here, that I am not talking about situation ethics. I am not aware of any ethical system that does not have to take into account the situation in which you find yourself. I mean, all ethics have to... I mean, I know this is kind of silly, but the motto I've always used in my head for this is, Christ may have said to give a cup of water in his name, but I don't give a cup of water in his name to a drowning man. I mean, that's not the situation in which the last thing he needs from me is a cup of water at that point. The situation determines whether a cup of water is appropriate. Well, situation ethics was a system that said this, basically. There is no transcendent principle of right and wrong. There is no revelation of the purposes of God, the will of God, the character of God that tells me what I ought to do in life. There is only basically one vague principle, which is love. Which is, if my actions work for another person's benefit, then I should do it. And that's the only principle that I have. And so the example that's always given in that case is, well, so if I'm talking to a woman who's severely depressed and she's desperately in need of reassurance and acceptance and warmth and so on, the loving thing to do would be to go ahead and have sex with her, because she would really benefit from that in this situation. Well, that's what we think of as situation ethics, that I just do whatever seems to be the best for the person in the moment, forgetting any other sort of principles involved. There is nothing that says that there's anything wrong with adultery, there's anything wrong with sexual immorality, there's nothing wrong or right with anything except sort of how it immediately affects the person that I'm dealing with. That's situation ethics, as it was classically defined. And Christian ethics are very, very far removed from situation ethics in that regard. What I'm saying, though, is that the unchanging principles that we learn through the Bible, and out of which we build a picture of life out of which to operate. Those unchanging principles work themselves out in different ways depending on what the situation is. Paul will not let Titus be circumcised, but he wants Timothy to be circumcised, because the unchanging principles out of which he is operating apply differently in a situation where the truth of the gospel is at stake or the opportunity for people to hear the gospel is at stake. Two different situations, and so the hierarchy of values plays itself out differently in each of those cases. That's what I'm saying is true. And I would say very much that that's true. That's ultimately how we as believers are going to live our lives. We're going to make our decisions about what we're going to do out of the picture we have of what life is all about, out of our worldview, in other words. And basically, whether you know it or not, this is what you do, would be my argument, is that in the end, we live out of our worldview. And David's statement, I think, is a very good one. It can be taken too far, but his statement basically is, you don't apply a verse, you apply a worldview. And that's what the Bible ought to be for us. It is a window on reality. It is giving me a picture of the way things are, changing my picture of the way things are, so that the world in which I am living is closer to the world that actually is. The farther that the picture of the world I have in my head is from the way things are, the more I am a fool. And the more that the picture I have in my head corresponds to the way things are, the more then my actions and choices are going to reflect wisdom. They're going to be in keeping with what is. And that's how we apply what the Bible has to say. Okay, well, we have a few minutes then for some questions or comments. You must have something to say after all of that.
Ron?
Yeah.
I'm going to be a punk, and I just wanted to ask a question about the Sabbath issue.
Okay.
And I totally agree with what you're saying. But I do have a question. In what sense can the Pharisees be blamed for their view of the Sabbath, and in what sense are they seeing a God who desires mercy rather than sacrifice when they see in Numbers 15, for example, a man collecting firewood on the Sabbath and being brought before the elders, and Moses goes before God and God says, strike him down with the stones.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I understand applying a worldview. I understand, you know, not taking one instance out of context and whatever. But in a sense, I guess I am arguing that even though we all, as well as the Pharisees, are completely blameworthy creatures, it is difficult sometimes to blame the Jews on one level for certain things, that it really did truly take Jesus speaking into that to really make things more clear for them. Does that make any sense?
Yeah. I guess it all depends on what you mean by blame.
Okay.
I think all of us ought to be sympathetic with the mistakes that they made.
You bet.
Because we make the same sort of mistakes ourselves. But I get a little bit in your comments a sense that, well, they couldn't, I mean, like the thing from Numbers you're talking about there, how could they be blamed because God wasn't clear? I don't think that's true.
Yeah. I think God was very clear, and in that, a man was caught collecting firewood. They bring him before Moses. Moses goes before God and God says, cut him off.
Right.
And so, in a sense, I, I guess that's why I'm saying I'm kind of being a punk. In what sense is God desiring mercy there rather than sacrifice? And how are the Pharisees supposed to understand that when they have this God making this decision back in their own law?
Right, right.
And I'm not looking for necessarily an answer. I guess I'm just saying I am wanting to be sympathetic with the Pharisees and their struggle to interpret.
Okay, well, again, it all depends on what we mean by blameworthy and by being sympathetic. I mean, when Jesus says, "Haven't you read?" to them, I think he's making a genuine and appropriate criticism of the Pharisees. That is, yes, we have a picture of God who made it clear that he meant business about the Sabbath. We have the whole story of the Babylonian captivity, which the prophets described in part as, in essence, this is a response to all of the Sabbaths that you didn't keep, you know, in the 7-year cycle and all of that sort of stuff. So yeah, God was serious about what he said. And yet at the same time, Jesus is saying, this is the God who did not strike David down when he took the showbread. This is the God who has said, I desire mercy and not sacrifice. This is the God of whom that David spoke to in an inspired psalm saying, you don't desire sacrifice or else I would give it. The sacrifices that you want are a broken and contrite spirit. So I have a complex picture of a God who clearly is into holiness and in a sense is communicating there is no compromise on the issue of holiness. And yet at the same time, I also see a picture of a God who gave a sacrificial system that made it possible for a person to be restored back into the covenant. I see a God who, as things go along, I discover that the religious aspects of the covenant that he made with Israel have a different purpose than the moral aspects, and then I have to sort all of that stuff out. And part of what Jesus is saying to the Pharisees is, in essence, you have consistently highlighted certain aspects of the revelation of God, which are there true enough, but you have downplayed other aspects of that revelation because you have not wanted to know it. You liked the picture that emerged. When you could make the Old Testament into a set of rules that if you've done these different things, then you're okay, you could look at your own life and say, yeah, I checked off everyone on the list. I did all of them, so I'm okay. And in essence, you took the commandments which were intended to teach you the seriousness of holiness and used it to trivialize holiness and pat yourself on the back and say, I'm a good guy.
Yeah.
So in that sense, they're blameworthy because, not because they weren't all brilliant exegetes, but because they were selective about what evidence in the Old Testament they would take in about how they ought to live. And they were selective out of evil motives, I think. So in that sense, they are blameworthy, and it's possible. I mean, we see in David someone who recognized he had the law, and yet he recognized that there were principles running under it that were deeper than the issue of outward obedience to the commands and stuff. So, yeah, so I'm sympathetic with us being sympathetic because it's very easy for us to get cocky because Jesus came along and explained some things to us better than were explained to them. Yeah, we don't want to be cocky about that. On the other hand, I think there was something genuinely wrong there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks, Ron.
Anything else?
the relationship between like the Old Testament, some of its commandments. It's very interesting. Kind of want to hear what you have to say to the response to this person who I was talking with. And she presented it like, well, she's an atheist. She doesn't know a lot about the Bible. But she looked at like some of the Old Testament laws about like, cleanliness and things like that, and about like, you know, I don't know, women's menstrual cycles and it being unclean and these things, and sort of looked at that kind of like that was old and weird, and that that people, as they've evolved, have religion has also evolved and come from a place where they associate the physical with the spiritual, but eventually we come to the place where we see that the spiritual transcends the physical and things like that. And I could sort of see, like, even a Christian, how they might play along with that, along how the Bible progresses. You know, it starts out, you know, associating, you know, physical things with spiritual things. By the time you get to Jesus, you know, the physical isn't too much of a big deal. It's all about the spiritual. Mm-hmm. And so how would you critique someone who has problems with the Old Testament along those lines? Would you say, no, they really understood, you know, the real nature of things? Or do you kind of give them credence that, yeah, maybe they didn't quite understand all that was going on there, and as such.
Okay. That's a big question. This might sound like it's not relevant. I hope it ends up being relevant at the end. I didn't mention at the beginning, but I should have mentioned probably that if anything coherent has escaped from my lips tonight, it's a miracle, kind of on the order of the loaves and fishes and stuff, because I've been writing all day long, and at a certain spot I just burned out all of my circuits. My family will tell you I was sitting there at dinner just sort of staring at my plate, looking, And so my brain isn't working very well tonight, actually. And I noticed it as I was speaking. I was wondering, I wonder if any of this makes any sense. But so now I'm going to try to answer a really hard question, and we'll see how that works. Jack tells a story of going to Israel with Dr. Bruce Waltke, who is a professor of Old Testament. Some of you have heard the story before. And they go into, they're at the ruins of a Canaanite temple. And he's going along and he's saying, okay, so here's the altar and here's the Holy of Holies and here's the, and everybody's going, whoa, what are you talking about? You know, this sounds like a terrible thing to be saying, because are you saying that the temple in the time of the Old Testament was just like everybody else's temples, you know, with the same stuff? Are you saying that Jewish religion is just a version of Canaanite religion, and, you know, just came about the way it all came about through people making up various weird things? And no, Waltke is a believer and wouldn't say a thing like that, but I think we have to recognize the challenge that something like that presents to us, that the Mosaic law and the regulations of the law and all of that are presented as being, having been given to Moses by God. And yet, we find parallels in the religious practices of the Jews with parallels in the religions around them. There are also great differences, but there are places where they come up and they have similar things going on. So, what I understand to be the case there, and I actually think it's a very helpful picture to have, and it's an encouraging picture to me, is that God, on the one hand, is working with a people at a certain place in history who have a certain religious understanding already with certain religious influences around them, and he has taken the things that they are familiar with and used them to put together a set of religious practices that he gives through Moses. And yet at the same time, he plays off of them. He takes them, he changes them. He changes the meaning of them. he takes practices that the Canaanites do around them and says, you will not do that. So what I have is the wisdom of God as manifested in a set of religious instructions that are accommodating and challenging of people in a particular historical situation. So in a way, certain aspects of what I find in the Old Testament are reflective of the level of understanding that people had in that region of the world at that time, because God is working with those people. And yet the principles that are communicated through those practices are a reflection of the unchanging God in his holiness and purity and mercy and all of that stuff. So, yeah, in that sense, it's like Paul talks about the law being a tutor to lead us to Christ. That there is, God took Israel through a whole set of experiences and a set of religious practices as well that confronted them with all kinds of issues that ultimately prepared them to kind of cut away some of the religious stuff and get to what's at the heart of this. But religion was the tool that was used to get them to the spot where religion would be less of an issue. Religion in the sense of ritual and that sort of thing. So, now, to the person that you're talking about, the critic in that way, there's nothing I can say, because if you haven't gotten to the point where you recognize the fundamental validity of the picture of the Creator God, sinful humanity, our need for salvation from death and guilt,